Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to some legalese.
The accused is guilty of the offense of contravening the provisions of Section 90, read with Sections 1, 103, 117.
That is the South African judge in the Oscar Pistorius trial with a dense legal explanation of her verdict in that murder trial. Not guilty of murder, guilty of what's being called culpable homicide. There's also some arcane legalese justifying the Obama administration's proposed new military operation in Iraq and Syria. We will look at both cases this hour. At the end of the hour, two people fighting to save a relationship and losing the battle. Actor James McAvoy talks about the challenges in the epic film project, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. But we begin with a discussion of disappearing birds being chased away by the consequences of climate change and the consequences of a broad international coalition that have been positive for the environment. In the decades since the 1987 Montreal Protocol, which phased out ozone-depleting chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, the United Nations and the World Meteorological Organization reports that damage to the ozone layer has been reversed, and the United Nations projects it could make a significant recovery by mid-century. Joining us to assess this seeming good news on the environment is David Biello, editor at Scientific American. Yozone, dude.
Yozone.
Hey, so this actually is something that we've known, at least in terms of the trend line, for a while, but the recovery seems very significant here.
It is, and that's all thanks to a, as you put it, broad international coalition of the willing, who were willing and able to take on this problem, which at the time they took it on was an $8 billion a year industry. So not insignificant.
Was it controversial when this coalition got together, at least in the way that would remind us of the controversy that surrounds climate change in some quarters?
The parallels are almost eerie. You had the CEO of DuPont, appearing in the national media calling the theory of the ozone hole science fiction, and a theory, not a fact, which is very reminiscent of the climate change debate. You had Fred Singer, an expert who is still occasionally trotted out on climate change, who actually still disputes that the ozone hole exists or that we should do anything about it, sowing doubt about the harsh economic impacts. Thousands of jobs supposedly at risk, and it turns out once we decided to do something about it, you could make even more money off the alternatives.
In environmental terms, what is the consequence to the planet, ultraviolet radiation, whatever, of a restoration of the ozone layer over the next several decades?
Well, it's good news for skin cancer. As you may know, ultraviolet light is one of the leading causes, if not the leading cause, of skin cancer around the world. And in some sense, we undertook this mission for the Chileans, Argentinians, Australians, Kiwis of the world who are at risk from this kind of expanding ozone hole of developing even more melanoma than we already do. Melanoma is a significant disease, and I believe the United Nations Environmental Program estimated that we've avoided about 2 million cases thanks to ozone hole action. And what really kind of helped in this ozone hole fight was when some British scientists down in Antarctica actually discovered it in 1985. So it was a theory in the 1970s. People were calling for action. And then some British scientists detected it over Antarctica. And then the world freaked out.
Any lessons from that in the climate change debate right now? Any sign that a coalition might be forming despite the controversy and debate?
Well, there are some signs, including among those who led the charge for the ozone hole action, like George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State in the Reagan administration, as you might remember. He had his weekly meetings with Ronald Reagan and helped convince him that, hey, we ought to take insurance policy on this whole ozone hole action thing. He's making the exact same arguments now to do something about climate change. And he's one of those kind of pesky grandparents who wants to leave a better world for his grandchildren.
All right. David Biello is editor at Scientific American. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
He joined us from New York. Now to the birds, where the news is not so good. The call of a cerulean warbler may soon be heard only in recordings. Imagine the northern lake without the common loon. In a new report, the Audubon Society projects that climate change is likely to chase about half of the approximately 650 species in the bird population of North America to new habitats. Dr. Gary Langham, Vice President and Chief Scientist of the National Audubon Society, has for the first time mapped this bird and climate data, and the visual impact of the effect, he says, is shocking.
When we found that nearly half of all the birds in North America are going to be at serious risk from climate change, that was really a dramatic moment. And in addition, 126 of those birds had a result that I really wasn't expecting. When you think about mountaintop species, it's not hard to imagine that climate change will cause them to lose range considerably as they get pushed up the mountain. They literally run out of places to go. But we don't typically associate that with birds in the lowlands. The study showed that for 126 of our birds, some of our most beloved birds like the eagle and brown pelican and common loon, that in most cases the range is actually just shrinking without anywhere to go. And so perhaps that was the most surprising thing of all. When we thought about the dramatic results of half the birds, you know, at first that is, of course, a gut punch and quite shocking as well. On the other hand, when you start looking at all the other studies done on climate change for plants and animals, both in the U.S. and abroad, you find that they're really all telling you the same story of somewhere between 40 and 70% of whatever organisms are being looked at are at serious risk from climate change.
And is that because of the temperature or because of food supply or because of available breeding sites?
Yeah, it could be a combination of those things. And as you mentioned before, it's very complex. And one of the great things about the Audubon Report is it translates a lot of that complexity, the highest level building blocks that nature depends on of temperature, precipitation, and seasonality. What we did was we combined thousands and thousands of observations over the last 30 years for each species, related it to those climate variables. And the neat thing is you can project it back onto a map that's much easier to understand and interpret than a series of numbers.
Well, before we talk about the data, the big data visualization here, which I think is the other piece of the story, let's look at some other species, because I think there are specific species where food supply is really the issue here. Give me an example there.
Well, some of the things we're seeing today as an impact, direct impact of climate change are changes in ocean temperature. So Atlantic puffins, for example, in Maine, this year was pretty good, but the last 2 years, the waters were so warm that the fish population shifted and the parents were bringing back fish that were too big for the chicks to eat. And this was having severe impacts, including deaths of the chicks.
That's a really subtle impact and something that you would not really expect necessarily to be the, you know, climate change consequence. That's sort of fascinating. What about insect populations and the impact on bird species that rely on insects for food?
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine that these broad building blocks like temperature and precipitation that are so dramatically disrupting birds will, of course, disrupt everything the birds depend on, and for that matter, everything that people depend on as well.
How common is the rufous hummingbird or the three-toed woodpecker, and is the threatening of those species a matter of a large population, you know, plummeting in some sense?
Yeah, so both of those species are examples of birds that the study found is going to be at risk from climate change and have dramatic losses through the end of the century. You know, it's not hard to imagine that for the hummingbird, this could also impact the flowering patterns and timing of the nectar-giving plants that they depend on. And for the woodpecker, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that. So 13 species of woodpecker are included in the study that are going to be dramatically impacted by climate. And what's not included in our study, but that is related to climate, are things that impact the trees they depend on. When you get the tree die-offs, you start getting more insects coming in to attack them, more fires, things like that. So starting with the results of our study, climate change can come in and make it even worse through indirect and direct effects, too.
So scientists have been frustrated by the fact that, you know, often scientific reports aren't the kinds of things that people necessarily read, and the media sometimes will distill a news headline, a scientific headline, down to a sort of distorted, oversimplified headline. In this particular case, you've really been able to use data and data visualization to allow people to really see the big picture in a scientifically responsible way. Can you describe how you designed the presentation of this data?
Sure. Well, one of the great things about the study is that you can visualize it in maps, and it's nothing like a map and people looking at it to spark conversations and get people talking. We're very hopeful that by presenting the 314 most at-risk species on the audubon.org/climate website, that people will go, they'll see that birds in their own state or their own community are at risk, and that will drive conversations and move them to greater action. And it, really, our ability to project these complicated climate variables and the bird responses in easily understood maps, we think is going to really help motivate people to take action.
So in the 22nd century, we're really looking at a world full of crows, blue jays, and grackles.
Yeah, well, some birds are going to do better, that's for sure. And we found that 274 species weren't directly susceptible to climate the way the 314 were. On the other hand, even the birds that we might consider to be safe, if you want to think about it that way, can still be disrupted from what we're seeing here. One of the birds that's shown to be shifting and might even increase its range by 2,000% is the Mississippi kite. Right now, that bird is a colonial breeder. It's a raptor, eats small vertebrates like lizards, and its range is going to shift north. So the open question is, can the bird actually move its colonial mating system north to take advantage of the new climate? And importantly, what's it going to eat when it gets there? Maybe one of these stable species that it eats, it's actually going to be the thing that disrupts them the most. And so even stable species are going to be disrupted, and that's really the bottom line message.
Dr. Gary Langham is Chief Scientist of the National Audubon Society. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
We are interested in the habitat where you are. Noticed any changes?
My name is Nancy Hines. I live in Fort Worth, Texas. I must say, horned toads are critters I have not seen in 40 years. And now that you mention it, bees, yellow jackets, wasps, butterflies, dragonflies, ladybugs, sparrows, and mockingbirds, grackles, garter snakes.
Nancy's diminishing menagerie there. Well, the horned toad and the ladybug's loss may be the flower's gain. From Salem, Oregon, 20 years ago, the violets were gone by mid-March. This year, they were still blooming in July.
I work for the county, mowing and clearing guardrails here. I don't see a whole lot of butterflies or quail anymore. The grasshoppers are just downright biblical.
That's Shannon in northeast Oklahoma. Dallas, Texas has too many mosquitoes. They love the extra hot summers and seem to stick around later into the year than they're used to. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of this conversation, and you can find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The U.S. government has had a more or less open-ended authorization to go after al-Qaeda since a few days after 9/11. The Authorization for Use of Military Force, or AUMF, was passed by Congress on September 14, 2001. But more than a decade later, and a year after the attack that killed Osama bin Laden, President Obama said the AUMF may have run its course.
I look forward to engaging Congress and the American people in efforts to refine and ultimately repeal the AUMF's mandate. And I will not sign laws designed to expand this mandate further. Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue. But this war, like all wars, must end.
The president is now demanding that the AUMF be dusted off, though, and used to justify the fight against ISIS or ISIL because of, quote, ISIL's longstanding relationship with al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. That's the reasoning, anyway, from a senior administration official this week. Jennifer Daskal is assistant professor at American University Washington College of Law and founding editor of the Just Security blog. She says because there is no political will to tamper with a reauthorization, the AUMF stands for now.
As I'm sure you're well aware, the AUMF that we're talking about was passed 13 years ago, just after September 11th, in response to the September 11th attacks. and it authorized the president to use force against those responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Now, fast forward 13 years later, and rather than enacting a new authorization to deal with the threat posed by ISIS, the administration, apparently with Congress's acquiescence, is now continuing to rely on this 13-year-old authorization to suggest that ISIS is a successor organization or has been split off from Al-Qaeda and therefore is covered under this pretty old authorization in a way that seems at least to stretch what anybody intended back in September of 2001.
It does seem like there's a lot of precedent for open-ended war in the United States since World War II, in the sense that, you know, we haven't declared war, like is the constitutional requirement. And, you know, the Cold War, the War on Terror all seem to be open-ended, and both Congress and the White House seem to be pretty happy with that arrangement.
My guess is that in the best of all worlds, that the president would have loved to go to Congress and get the authorization specific to ISIS, specific to use force against ISIS. In fact, the president himself said last May that he wanted to refine and ultimately repeal the 2001 AUMF. But by all accounts, what happened is that Congress simply didn't want to take a vote on this before the November elections, that despite a lot of public critique and commentary about Obama's prior statement about a lack of strategy and complaints that he wasn't strong enough in face of the execution of two Americans, that Congress itself was very willing to complain, but not willing, with the exception of a handful of senators and representatives who did urge a vote, including Tim Kaine and Mark Udall and Bill Nelson and several others, but most representatives and most senators prefer to just let the president go at it without having to put their own political future on the line, without having to take a potentially controversial position.
As a lawyer, does an outraged citizen have standing to challenge this, or is it up to someone in Congress or even a majority vote in Congress to challenge this?
Well, it's very hard to challenge. For one, the 2001 AUMF explicitly directs the president to use force against those groups, that organizations and individuals who he determines are effectively responsible for September 11th. And by all accounts, the administration's lawyers have settled on a theory that ISIS and Al-Qaeda joined forces at one point. They were part of a common organization, that the two organizations split, that ISIS deems itself the successor to bin Laden and the successor to the organization that attacked us on September 11th. So under some plausible theory, it's hard to say that the president couldn't possibly determine that this group falls within the 2001 AUMF, but it is a stretch to say the least. And it is certainly not what anybody intended back in 2001. And given that there's been bipartisan support and complaint about the way in which the 2001 AUMF has been stretched to cover groups that didn't even exist on 9/11, it certainly is bad policy, even if it's good politics in the short term.
You referenced the fact that the president really wanted to ultimately repeal this AUMF. What is the sort of body of law that the president was operating under when he seemed to want this to go away?
Well, so the president continues to take offensive action to launch strikes, lethal targeting, against groups that are so-called associated forces of Al-Qaeda.
That would include the Somalia and Yemen attacks that the president was referring to in his speech this week, right?
Exactly, precisely. And so ultimately, I mean, there were two options. One, a determination at some point that these other groups do not pose the kind of threat that warrant an ongoing use of force authorization, that if there are certain situations arise where there's evidence that a group or an individual is planning an imminent attack against the United States, the president can always rely on his Article II authorities, his self-defense authorities, to take actions to protect the nation or U.S. personnel, or alternatively, a decision that the 2000 AUMF, which was directed specifically at those responsible for the September 11th attacks, has outlived its usefulness. In the words of President Obama, Al-Qaeda Corps has been decimated, and that, if anything, it ought to be repealed and replaced with a much narrower and targeted authorization to deal with the specific organized groups that pose the kind of threat that can't be addressed adequately through other means.
So, Jennifer Daskal, what's your best guess? I know it's speculative. Do you think the president is hesitant, is reluctant, is not happy about doing it this way, or would actually rather have a kind of open-ended AUMF that allows almost anything to take place under its rubric?
So my guess is that the president was serious when he said that he wanted to refine and ultimately repeal the 2000 AUMF, and that if he were confident that he could get the kind of authorization that he thinks he needs to deal with ISIS and to potentially deal with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, he would go to Congress and seek that authorization. The problem is, and I guess the concern is that the president goes to Congress and he doesn't get what he needs, or he goes to Congress and Congress says, as the reporting suggests, actually, we don't want to take a vote. We would rather you just go at it under existing authorities and put us in the awkward position, the difficult position of taking a vote right before Election Day in November.
Jennifer Daskal, assistant professor at American University Washington College of Law and founding editor of the Just Security blog. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
History-making verdict in South Africa this week in a criminal trial with a black judge presiding over the trial of a rich white defendant.
The accused is found not guilty and is discharged. Instead, he is found guilty of culpable homicide.
South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius was found guilty of culpable murder, a lesser charge to premeditated murder the prosecution was seeking in the death of his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp. The Pistorius trial has attracted worldwide attention since it opened in March and has divided South Africans on issues of racial justice, gun violence, and violence against women, all longstanding challenges in South Africa. We welcome back the BBC's Southern Africa correspondent, Namsa Maseko. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what is the emotional reaction in South Africa? We've heard a lot of legal discussion and very detailed legal arguments in the verdict reading, but the country is beginning to digest this. What's going on?
Well, I can tell you that the impact of the verdict today is still going around South Africa because this trial has gripped South Africa for the past 5 months, and people are saying that the Oscar Pistorius should have been found guilty of murder, and that is the court of public opinion, of course. But if you look at what the judge has had to do, is that she has had to have a look at the evidence that was brought before her to court, because the onus was on the state prosecutor to prove its case of premeditation murder beyond reasonable doubt. Now, the court, Judge Thokozile Masipa, felt that there was not enough evidence to prove that there was murder. There was not enough evidence to prove that there was an intention to kill. And that is why Oscar Pistorius was just found guilty of negligence. He fired those four shots. He acted hastily, as the judge has said, and that he was negligent and had used excessive force. So he has been found guilty of culpable homicide and also gun-related charges, where he fired a gun at a packed restaurant, and the judge said that he endangered the lives of at least 200 patrons.
How much is this a verdict on the prosecution? Will people be outraged at the behavior of the prosecution, or was the burden of unreasonable doubt really too hard for the prosecution to reach here?
Well, the burden of proof was on the prosecution to prove whether or not Oscar Pistorius, had acted or he had planned the murder, as what the prosecutor was saying. But at the end of the day, it is not just the prosecution that has been on trial, but also the judiciary, South African justice system, South African police were also on trial, because there were, they had said that there was some bungling on the police's side in terms of investigation. As you'd recall, the first investigating officer Hilton Botha has now, he was released of his duties because he was accused of having contaminated the crime scene itself, and he has now left the police force, but he still faces attempted murder charges on an unrelated case. So it was not just the judiciary that was on trial here, but also South African police, who have also been accused of having stealing Oscar Pistorius's watches on the day they had gone to Oscar Pistorius's house to investigate the killing of Riva Steenkamp.
the judge at the center of this case, how has she fared in these 5 months of having the highest profile of any judge in South African history?
Well, she has been criticized by a lot of people who thought that she would find Oscar Pistorius guilty of murder, of killing Reeva Steenkamp. But at the same time, a lot of people were saying that should have the onus was on the state to prove that its case beyond a reasonable doubt that there was premeditation in Oscar's intentions to kill. And a lot of people also have come in defense of Judge Thokozile Masipa, saying that Gerrie Nel, as the prosecutor, should have made sure that he secures some concessions. And while Oscar Pistorius was under cross-examination, and therefore the judge should not have been expected to invent evidence inside that courtroom, and that is why she felt that this case, you know, that they could not prove premeditation at all.
How has the issue of gun violence and gun use in South Africa and violence against women been a part of this trial?
Well, when it first started out, this trial about 5 months ago, there were women's rights groups and NGOs coming, you know, protesting outside court, saying that the Oscar Pistorius trial had put back in the spotlight the abuse of women and children in South Africa. And if you look at statistics in South Africa, you know, 3 women a day here in South Africa are killed by their intimate partners. And they felt that if Oscar Pistorius killed his partner during a fight, because the prosecution was saying that there was a fight that led to the shooting, it means that Oscar Pistorius should have been made an example of as a celebrity, as a person who was once inspirational in this country, you know, should have been given a tougher jail sentence. But that is not the case, because there was simply not enough evidence to prove this. But at the same time, if you look at things now, the options available to the prosecutor now that Oscar Pistorius has only been found of a lesser charge of negligence and culpable homicide, it means that after sentencing, the prosecution can appeal the conviction and sentence of Oscar Pistorius.
And he could still get 15 years. You know, what was striking is all of this very dense legalese in the verdict really reminded me of the old white apartheid trials decades ago. But yet this is an African judge, a black judge, and a woman judge as well. How much does this represent change in South Africa?
Well, this is now, we're now into 20 years of a new and democratic South Africa. So this is quite something new in the way in which South Africa has been for decades or even centuries. A black judge coming from a poor background who lived in a two-bedroomed house with her parents. She used to sleep under the dining room table at her house while she was growing up. And even worse than when they had visitors at home, she had to sleep, you know, in the kitchen to accommodate the visitors. From somebody who comes from that kind of disadvantaged background to be addressing a rich, wealthy, white man in a South African court, that is something that is totally different. It's something that has been absolutely welcomed in the South African society and also, of course, the judiciary in South Africa, because if I can tell you, none of the people that were in this courtroom actually spoke their home languages. The judge is a Zulu a person. Oscar Pistorius, the prosecutor, and Oscar Pistorius's lawyer are Afrikaners. So you can imagine that none of these people were speaking in their first language, but here it is. This is the new South Africa.
Nomsa Maseko, BBC Southern Africa correspondent, speaking to us from Pretoria. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Poor, lonely Eleanor Rigby.
I need to try some other version of myself. We'll never get to where we were.
Where was that?
Someplace good.
I don't want to interfere with your life or whatever she has to do. But I can't just chalk this up to destiny. I walked on with my life because moving forward was the only way to go.
I guess people grieve differently.
These lonely people came from a new provocative movie, actually 3 movies, about one relationship. That's actor James McAvoy as Connor Ludlow. Jessica Chastain plays Eleanor Rigby in The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, which also features Isabel Huppert and Bill Hurt. In 3 separate films, we see distinct versions of the same story of a young couple grappling with the loss of their child. The version called Him from the perspective of Connor, Her from the perspective of the grieving mom, Eleanor, and a 3rd combined film, Them, piecing together their differing perspectives into a more traditional narrative. Actor James McAvoy sat down to talk about the new film and how the actors worked to establish two clear points of view.
We'd film the scene afresh each time, using different camera angles, using different lighting techniques, using different script at times, and allowing the scene to become what it wants to be, rather than trying to make it different for the sake of it. But it has to be said, sometimes the differences are tiny and sometimes the differences are massive. It's the way you remember an argument with your loved one, and if you maintain you were right and they maintain they were right, and there's got to, it's got to give somewhere. You can't both be right. And but also in terms of, we'd do a scene one way, maybe it would be a very sad scene, and then the next time we did it, the next day, it wouldn't be that sad scene. It would be an angry scene, or it would be a funny scene, or it would be... And you just let it be what it was going to become. So it wasn't just a case of him re-editing footage that he had to sort of make it slightly different or anything. It was completely fresh footage each time.
It was amazing to me how the two characters, you and Jessica Chastain, really are surprising each other with some of the lines that you come out with. There's a sort of a sense of, what's she going to do next? What's he going to do next? Was that really scripted, or was there a lot of spontaneity in those?
There's a lot of mix, really. Ned wrote a fantastic script, but, you know, we were also investigating a connection between two people, and sometimes that connection would lead to other places, and Jessica and I are both quite open to improv as well, and Ned was really happy for, if he'd got it in the can, he wanted to see where else the relationship could go.
And I'd say you guys are, you know, competing for, like, the most intense actors on the planet in this film. Do you compete at all? Is him better than her?
I think, you know, even to yes,
yes,
it is.
Yes,
it is. But that's the good thing about it as well, is you get to go see them both and compare which is the best, and then ultimately agree that mine is. You can see all three. You can just see him and her in a double bill. You can see him on its own, or you can see her on its own, or you can see the triple bill, or you can just see them. And there's something very contemporary about its distribution structure and the idea of these three films. It's all about choice, you know, and you can choose to see them in whichever order you went or you want.
You know, this is where film's going. You've got Boyhood, which is a very ambitious kind of, you know, different form. This is a different form. You've got, you know, Under Her Skin. You know, that's a very different kind of film, really. It's an exciting time.
Yeah, no, I think it is. And I think much is made of the CGI stuff. But all the while, every year, we've got interesting things coming out that either push back boundaries narratively, or push back taboo, or in terms of those two films that you mentioned in particular, push back just the structure of storytelling.
Yeah.
And in our case, the distribution of movies.
You know, this is all about a relationship. And, you know, unlike a movie that has a plot where X happens, then Y happens, then Z happens, this is really an immersion into a relationship. I would think that it would take over your life, just really maintaining the depth of this relationship as part of your acting. You know, you're saying lines, but you're also feeling all of this, it seems to me.
The film is very much about a couple trying to heal themselves as individuals and then hopefully find each other again afterwards. But it's fueled by their bereavement and by the tragedy and that they've suffered. And that runs through the whole thing. Even though we don't rest on the tragedy all the time, the whole thing is fueled by that tragedy. And that really was just behind every single line that I say in the film. That was something that was quite hard living with every day, and quite hard not to take home with you at the end of the day. But also, as much as it is about a relationship trying to heal itself or break up, arguably, it's a film about parenthood, but what happens to parents once the kid is gone as well, do you know what I mean? It's a film about trying to deal with the pain of adult love, and adult love is the adult love that you bear for your partner, but it's also adult love is towards children as well, do you know what I mean? And I think from Connor's point of view, she saw it as not necessarily failure, but just deep pain and deep loss. And there's no way to hide from it, and there's no way to forget it or unremember it, because you have the living DNA of your child in your other half, constantly being around you, reminding you of what they might have looked like and what they might have been. And so all you become is one half of a couple who lost a kid. And perhaps it's the idea of this movie is that in this particular couple, not in all cases, she had to heal herself before she could even think about healing a relationship. And that's not something that he's willing to accept. His reaction to the situation is completely different. His reaction is to try as hard as possible to forget. And he makes a really good fist of at least pretending that he has forgotten.
Just imagine how good this movie would have been if you'd gotten into your character at all.
No.
Yeah, you got way into it.
It was such an easy character to get into, though. It was weird. You know, it came very naturally. And I think that's partly because even though we spend a lot of time apart in the movie, it's about the relationship that we share, and it's about the absence of that relationship and the absence of that child. And she was such an open actor, Jessica, that we bonded on that relationship really early, and we bonded on the history of what happened to them really quickly, and we tried to share as much of the positive stuff and as much of the horrible stuff that happened to them. And we tried to realise it as fully as possible. So we sort of, on our first day, shared an incredible amount of baggage and incorporated stuff from our own lives as well. And so really, day two, we'd bared all in a lot of ways. And you were really able, therefore, to be vulnerable with each other and create, for what I think is a really tangible chemistry. And therefore, even when we're apart, the invisible line that connects two people is still taught.
Well, James, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Cheers for having me.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. James McAvoy stars in the new movie The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, opening in limited release today, going wide next weekend. And McAvoy, a true Scotsman through and through, also shared his impassioned thoughts on the upcoming vote for Scottish independence. He says the politics is clouding the debate, and it should be a matter of the heart.
Ireland fought, bled, and died for its independence. Do we fight and die for our independence now? No. We're talking about finance for independence. Now, do we want independence because we think we're going to be better off, or do we want independence because we just want it?
You can hear the rest of Glasgow native James McAvoy on The Takeaway Weekender. Just download our daily podcast, and every Saturday you'll get a special weekend edition of the show. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything you've heard this week, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.